Good afternoon, and welcome to today's webinar, Making the Grade, Debating School Performance Ratings. My name is Philip Lovell, and I'm the Vice President of Policy and Government Relations here at the Alliance for Excellent Education. I'm pleased to be joined today by Mike Petrilli, President of the Fordham Institute. Nice. We've got a hot topic for today. Policy wonks care about the nuts and bolts of school ratings, everything from whether we should have school ratings in the first place to what individual indicators should be and how much they should weigh. But this is a topic that isn't just important to policy people like myself and Mike Petrilli. School ratings are important to parents, to businesses, real estate agents, as everyone wants to live in a good neighborhood with a good school. So, what is a good school and how do you measure it? Everyone acknowledges that education is complex. Some people, like Mike Petrilli, believe it's important to boil that complexity down to a simple, understandable rating, like an A to F letter grade. Others, like myself, are a bit more skeptical. Under the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, states have flexibility to assign an A to F grade or some other rating, or not. They also have the flexibility when it comes to what goes into those ratings, but there are some federally set ground rules. For example, the law says that state accountability systems have to include at least four indicators: academic achievement as measured by proficiency in math and reading, progress in English language proficiency for English learners, a state-selected measure of school quality or student success, and then for elementary and middle schools, growth or another academic indicator, and for high schools, graduation rates. Now, the law also says that some of these indicators have to weigh more than others, and that the performance of historically underserved students must be measured as part of each indicator. There are other requirements, but by and large, these are the high points. Now, it's important to note that ESSA doesn't require states to assign a school an A to an F or a similar rating. Under the law, states must have an accountability system that identifies schools for support and improvement, but the decision to use a rating like A to F is up to them. The policies that will determine school ratings are being developed right now. Under ESSA, each state must develop a plan to implement the new law and have that plan approved by the Secretary of Education. And these plans include the state's rating systems. 17 states in the District of Columbia have been approved, just two were approved yesterday, and the remaining states are currently pending approval at the U.S. Department of Education. A number of organizations, including us here at All for Ed, have been analyzing the ESSA state plans with an eye towards not just their compliance with the statute, but also their focus on equity. You can find our ESSA equity dashboards at the link below. The Fordham Institute has also been looking at ESSA plans. They have analyzed each state's proposed school rating system, and in November, they issued a report, Rating the Ratings, an analysis of the 51 ESSA accountability plans. Mike is going to discuss that report, as well as the pros and cons of rating systems. But before we get that, we're going to have just a few housekeeping items. First, please follow us today on Twitter using the hashtag ESSA. And to ask a question of either myself or Mike, you can use the box below. The webinar will be archived for later viewing at www.allfored.org/webinars. Now, let me get to formally introduce our special guest, Mike Petrilli. In addition to serving as president of the Fordham Institute, Mike is a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's executive editor of Education Next and a distinguished senior fellow for Education Commission of the States. He's an award-winning writer. He's the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma and editor of Education for Upward Mobility. And Mike helped to create the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Innovation and Improvement. Pleased to have you on here with us today.
Great. Thanks for having me, Philip.
Excellent. So let's get started by having you describe why an A to F system is important in describing your report. Sure. And sharing some of the findings from your study.
All right, that sounds good. So I'm going to go ahead and click through a PowerPoint here to hit the highlights of what we looked at and what we found when we looked at the 51 ESSA plans. So let's go ahead. So again, rating the ratings. What we wanted to do was focus in on just a handful of things, Philip. You know, there are lots of other groups out there that have been evaluating the state plans. Probably the best known one is one from the Bellwether Education Partners and the Collaborative for Student Success. They had a very comprehensive review, looked at lots of pieces of what the state said. We honed in just on the accountability systems and really on the ratings, on the report cards that states have to put out where they tell the public and tell parents how each school in the state is performing. And in our view, and this is definitely based on our own normative values, we think that those ratings should have really three objectives. The first is to assign ratings that are clear and intuitive. I mean, this seems pretty straightforward, that if you're going to go through this process and you're going to try to provide transparency to the public and also put some pressure on schools to focus on improvement and do the tough things it takes to improve, then the ratings need to be clear. You know, back in the No Child Left Behind years, that was not always the case, often not the case.
What did AYP mean?
Yeah, I mean, have these ratings at AYP and continuous improvement, and who knows? There were states where you'd look at their ratings and it would say something like, you know, level 7.5, or, you know, these things didn't make sense to anybody. So we prefer to see A to F because that's very clear to people in education. Doesn't have to be that. It could be 5 stars, 1 to 100, something that is clear. The second thing is to send a signal to schools that in order to be considered a good school, you have to help all kids make progress, not just kids who are low performing or not just kids that are right near the proficiency line on state tests. And again, this comes from research from the No Child Left Behind years, where it was clear that in some places, at least, there was a whole lot of focus on the, quote, bubble kids, the kids right near the line, right under, right below that proficiency line. And not a lot of attention on everybody else. And that is, of course, not fair. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, it's just a terrible way to drive behavior at the school level. We want to make sure that every kid is paid attention to. And then third, to make sure that we are fairly measuring all schools, including high poverty ones. So again, back to No Child Left Behind. We had this problem where, especially towards the end, virtually every high poverty school in the country was labeled a failure. And that's because we were judging them based on mostly on proficiency rates and on graduation rates. And those kinds of rates are very strongly correlated with family background and with students' previous achievement. So if you're a high school and you have a lot of kids, most kids coming into you 2 or 3 grade levels behind, and you're going to be measured by whether or not kids get to the proficiency bar, well, guess what? You're going to be declared a failure. So what we argue here in this report is instead we need to focus much more on what schools control, and that is how much progress that kids make from 1 year to the next. Now, look, you'll notice that all of this discussion is still largely about student outcomes, student achievement. That is something that at Fordham we still think is incredibly important. That's not to say that you can't look at some other things as well, and of course the law opens the door to looking at other things like social-emotional learning or feedback from parents or teachers or even students. Fine with all of that. Now, I think most people who have reviewed these plans have found that so far there's not a lot of that in there.
It's actually not
yet.
Very much in there yet. For all there's the flexibility not. There is, just
no,
it's
and,
not.
Yeah. And the reason is there's not many measures out there that are ready for prime time.
Yeah.
The reason we use standardized testing is because it is valid and reliable. Yeah. We all know there's downsides, but it is hard to find other alternatives. But we're open to them. But we do believe that schools should be evaluated primarily on whether kids are seeing success because of that school, and you measure that by looking at where kids are when they come in and where kids are when they leave or from year to year. And so that's what we were looking for. When we dug into the plans, again, clear intuitive labels, for each category we gave a strong, medium, or weak. Again, strong, A to F, or 5 stars, something like that. Medium would be text labels, as long as they're somewhat easy to understand. You know, they weren't gibberish. And then the weak ones were the ones where it was really just these data dashboards, where you've got tons of information, as required by the law, broken down, but no kind of summative assessment. Now, we're going to talk a lot about this, Philip. Note that states didn't have to have just a single rating, okay, if they wanted to have, you know, 5 grades, for example, that would be fine. They'd still get a strong here. But if they had nothing but just a slew of data that they were asking parents and taxpayers,
no context,
that didn't count. And if all they did was come up with a way of determining which schools were going to be subject to interventions, which is required by the law, which are really the lowest 5 or 10% of schools, plus schools that maybe aren't doing well by subgroups. If that's all they did, they got a week. Okay, because what that meant is that 90% or let's say 80% of schools out there are not going to get any kind of rating, and nobody's going to really know how they're doing. So how do states do on this front? Well, actually, quite well. This is where we are quite optimistic about the state plans under ESSA. Maybe one of the only organizations out there who actually thinks states did a pretty good job, at least on this. That 69% got strongs. Arizona is one of the A to F states, for example, so there's a state that did quite well. We found that basically 40 of the states decided to have some kind of summative rating for their schools, 40. And keep in mind, Philip, that number could have been zero.
Yeah, they didn't have to under the law.
They did not have to. They could have all said, we're just getting out of the rating business. In my view, in our view, that would have been a big step back for accountability. But, you know, so we think it's pretty good news, actually, that states, given this flexibility, decide to stick with it. The focus on all students. Here we wanted to see various ways that states could indicate that all kids matter. That is either by using a performance index or scale scores. So not to get too wonky, but basically to say, hey, if you're going to look at how many kids, what percentage of kids get to proficiency, make sure you look at other performance levels too, like how many kids get to basic, how many kids get to advanced, and then turn that into an index. Or just look at scale scores, which are basically, you know, the average score that kids get all mushed together. And then look at growth as well. Growth, and we're open to different kinds of growth models, but growth over time. So if at least 50% of the ratings came to that, we viewed that as strong. At least 33% was medium, and below that was weak. Here again, the states did pretty well, not quite as well, but again, 45% strong, which is certainly a majority. I'd say about two-thirds of the states, we think, are doing either, you know, okay or quite well on this front. So that's, again, good news. We don't think we're going to see the same problem we saw under No Child Left Behind with the focus on just the bubble kids or just the low performers. We're hopeful. We at Fordham are very concerned about high-achieving, low-income kids. We think they're going to get a lot more attention under this law. Colorado, we think, is a real exemplar here with 95% of their rating focused on scale scores and growth. Again, sending that message that everybody's got to make improvements. And then fair to high-poverty schools. A little different here, again, focusing on growth as the best way to...
Yes, growth is definitely the theme, growth I think, is the of, theme. The Fordham analysis.
Now, here we're open to different kinds of growth. Some states, for example, have growth to proficiency. You know, are low-performing kids making progress towards this proficiency bar? Or growth for certain subgroups? We're fine with that. We just want to see growth. This is where the states, in our view, actually do the worst, that there's still too many states out there, if you look at this, who don't put enough focus on growth. And we worry that means, in lots of states at least, it's still going to be very hard for high-poverty schools to get good ratings, just because the kids are coming in, again, so far behind, mm-hmm. and they're being asked to get them to this very high standard. You know, there'll be some schools that are amazing schools that are able to do that. But we worry that there's going to be plenty of high-poverty schools given C's and D's or the equivalent that are actually doing a pretty good job, and it's not going to show up in the state ratings. So... that is what we looked at, Philip. And, you know, let me just say one thing about why we think these ratings are important. You know, there's folks out there, California has probably been the most vocal, officials from California, making the argument that we should not do this school rating thing anymore. What we should do is provide lots of data, lots of information, so that when school leaders sit down with their teams and they're working on school improvement plans, they have a lot of information that they can draw from, and they can use that for improvement. I would say that that's fine. We have no problem with dashboards, but it should be both and. School improvement teams should have access to lots of data, but we do think it's important for the parents and the public to have access to some kind of summative judgment about how the school is doing. Again, it doesn't have to be a single grade. It doesn't have to be all boiled down to one A or one F. It could be, you know, maybe a grade for growth and another grade for achievement and maybe one for, you know, social emotional learning. You could have a handful of grades like you'd see in a report card. But some kind of summative judgment so that we're telling parents the truth. If their kid is in a school that is being judged by a good accountability system and yet is still not making any progress. Okay, let's say it's an F on achievement and it's also an F on growth. I mean, that school is brain dead. The parents deserve to know. And if all they get is a website with all these databases and a blizzard of numbers, they may not get that message. Now, it is one other thing that they might do, that those parents might end up doing, is going to other places that are willing to give them a rating, like gradeschools.net. Mm-hmm. And so I'd also say to states, look, if you're not willing to come out and sort of tell a bottom line, someone else is going to do it, and they're going to do it probably using data that are much less nuanced. You know, they're probably just going to look at proficiency rates, or they're just going to look at test scores. So if you want to compete with grade schools as a rating that people pay attention to, then you need to make it user friendly.
No, very helpful. So thanks very much for the presentation. You know, I agree with a decent amount of what you're saying.
Yep.
Clarity is important. Parents, the public, students, the business community, what have you.
You should stop right there, Phil. You should stop right there because that's it. You agree.
Of those things are true. What I get concerned about is the difference between clarity mm-hmm. and accuracy.
Yeah.
So when I go to the doctor, for example, mm-hmm. right? I go there, they take my height,
mm-hmm.
hasn't changed. They take my weight, unfortunately, that's gone up a bit.
Yeah.
They take my blood pressure, a couple other tests, mm-hmm. right? And I get told how I'm doing on each individual thing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't wrap it up into a somewhat of score because each individual thing is different.
Right.
And it seems to me that with education, it's fairly similar. If a school gets an A, mm-hmm. the message, by and large, school's good.
Yep.
If you get an F or a D, by and large, school's not so good.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a B or C especially,
mm-hmm.
What does that really tell you,
yeah.
knowing that these different things are, they're just that. They're right. very different. So what does the letter grade actually tell you?
All right, but so let me go back with another analogy from the mm-hmm. doctors, right? When I go, I also often get a blood test, mm-hmm. and I get that blood test back, and they're looking at 30 different things, and it's all in small type, and I'm trying to figure out, and it'll tell you something. I don't even know what the heck this stuff is, and what the range is, and what your number means, and are you in range or not? Well, that's all I got, and it turned out that there was something in that test showing that there was a problem. I might miss it. My eyes are glazing over. I don't know what it means. It's important for the doctor to also say, hey, I have analyzed your blood test, and here's the bottom line. You need to worry about X, Y, or Z, and here's what we're going to do about it. So,
true.
So, I'm asking for both here. Mm-hmm. Now, where I agree with you, Philip, is that there is a danger that if it's a single summative grade, and that's it, that invariably, when you mush all these different things together, you're going to lose some context and some accuracy, and that could be a problem. And probably, just because of the way the math works, you're going to end up with a whole lot of schools in the middle. It's going to be the case that a lot of schools are strong on one thing and weak on another, and so everybody gets a C.
You're
and that may not be
my
very
point.
Useful.
Yes.
Yeah. No. So I hear that. Yeah. So look, I think where we have agreement is that maybe there is a happy medium, which is to say, there should be grades. They should be clear, but they don't have to be single. Maybe a handful. In Ohio, where we do a lot of on-the-ground work, we like their report card on the whole. I think a lot of the other ratings like there. They do A to F. But it's actually so many grades. I think they're up to something like 15 grades that get A to Fs. It's now too much. Mm-hmm. It's overwhelming. And so we have made a proposal to try to shrink it back down again to, I think, 6. Manageable.
Yeah.
And can set some clear. And as a charter school authorizer, we think about those grades in Ohio. We think about the two grades are most important. The achievement grade. Now that one, they'd use a performance index, but still, it is largely correlated with demographics, mm-hmm. prior achievement. So you tend to see high poverty schools get low grades on that. But then the growth. And growth.
I'm so surprised.
All right. And what you'll see, Philip, is you'll see schools like the fantastic Kipp School in Columbus will get like a D on achievement and an A on growth. And to us, that A is much more representative. But if there's a school that gets an F on achievement and an F on growth, and that happens, two or three years in a row, that tells you that school is brain dead. And there's a big problem there. And so that, if you don't
hashtag
have that
brain
data,
dead, yes.
in California, how would you ever know? I don't know. People are going to count out the number of reds, or they're going to look. I mean, they have to look at this incredible blizzard of information, and nobody in a position, an official position, is willing to say, here's the bottom line. Your school stinks.
And I do think that it's important to differentiate, though, between where a school maybe a little performing mm-hmm. and not, which is, I mean, that's, you know, math is different from reading, is different from graduation rates, is different from growth.
Right.
So I'm glad that, that you have agreed with the notion of it's not just the single summative score.
Yeah.
That it's the, so it seems like there's,
I concede on that point.
That's great.
You know, it might be worth, Phil, just spending a few moments here talking about why it's important to have these external ratings in the first place, right? Because I can understand, like, if you're an educator, let's say you're a principal, you know, you might say, why are you trying to rate me, or why are you trying to put all this pressure on me? And I can get that, that what you want data that you can use to build an improvement plan. You'd like to see how you're doing compared to similar schools, or if there's some lessons to be learned by other, maybe there's a school near you that's really crushing it on one of these indicators. You want to know that. But you say, give me the data. Why, you know, you don't need to hit me over the head with a grade. And my response would be that, look, in any part of our society, certainly in the public sector, we have this challenge of how to hold big institutions accountable. And you know, in the private sector, we have the same problem. You go in, there's big bureaucratic companies that are provide poor service or where the quality is uneven. And so it's not like it's perfect there. But at least in the private sector, there is this thing called competition. And that you hope that if it's working, if the market's working, whatever the field, whether it's restaurants or insurance or whatever, people, you know, these companies have an incentive to keep their customers happy, to keep their, you know, to earn more profits. That forces them to try to keep focusing on getting better and to make difficult decisions. You know, if there's an employee that is not doing what they need to do or is in the wrong role, to address it rather than just look the other way and work around it. You know, if they have a vendor that's not doing what they need to do, to actually address it, to make the tough decisions. And my theory, Philip, is that basically every organization in the history of the world of any size over time, you know, becomes complacent and becomes more bureaucratic and just the performance lags unless there's some countervailing force. So, you know, again, the private sector competition mm-hmm. doesn't always work. We all go into bad restaurants or we all get, you know, but, you know, it's a reasonable force. How do you do that in the public sector? It's a real challenge. You know, how do you make DMVs better? How do you make police departments better? How do you make, you know, public universities and hospitals better? It's no easy thing, but the hope is by putting some pressure on these institutions, and this accountability for results is one way to do it, to say, we're gonna try to look at all this data, we're gonna try to do it in a fair way, as we've described in our report, and we're gonna come out with a judgment about how you're doing, that this is gonna put some pressure on you. It's also gonna give the superintendent or the principal some leverage to say, hey, if we don't wanna get a bad grade on this report, which is going to hurt, be negative for us in a variety of ways, we need to make some changes. And so we need to, you know, fire, you know, the textbook vendor that we've been using and go in a different direction. We need to address low teacher performance that's not working. We need to stop investing in this technology thing that's not working and invest in this instead. That's the hope.
You're seeing the letter grades as giving somewhat of both the extra external push
yep.
to make change
yep.
and sort of the sense of urgency.
Yeah, that's right.
Around
and,
that.
And there's evidence from the No Child Left Behind days that this pressure, mm-hmm. even though the law had all kinds of problems and is, you know, the design looks archaic now by our standards, you know, it did work. That in the late 90s and early 2000s, when states adopted consequential accountability systems, and then No Child Left Behind came along, those early adopter states, they saw improvements in performance. And then the other states saw improvements once No Child Left Behind happened, especially for the lowest performing kids who were the focus of those reforms. So there's some evidence that it can work. Now look, if we had every single school in our country, 100,000 schools or whatever we've got, each one of those had a phenomenal principal who woke up every day asking, how can we improve this school? And let's look at our data and let's galvanize change. We wouldn't need any of this. Right. But, you know, that's not the world we live in. And I'd say, look, that's not the world in any field. You just don't have that kind of amazing leadership in every line position that you would necessarily need. You need something else. And the hope is that the push gets us there.
Yeah, sure.
And look, and for those schools that have great leaders, it is overkill. They don't need it. You know, they're going to get better anyway. But so there's way too few of those schools.
You're definitely, you know, right about, you know, the need for capacity to be enhanced at all yep. levels there. But I, to me, the value of the dashboard type approach is that whether you're doing well or whether you're doing poorly, mm-hmm. it's important to know.
Yep.
Right? Right. If you're doing, you know, whether it's grad rates, reading proficiency, growth, what, you know, the, right. the
but Philip, you're going to have, every state's going to have a dashboard, right? I mean, they have to, under the law, publish data on every single one of their indicators. So they'll have it.
The downfall, though, I think, of the, part of the downfall of the summative score, though, is the way in which high performance on one indicator, as you were mm-hmm. saying, can mask low performance on another.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see this all the time, say, with graduation rates mm-hmm. and achievement, where you've got, in fact, we've looked at state data, and in one state, for example, there are 72 high schools where, looking at African-American students, mm-hmm. Their graduation rate for African-American students was in the 80s.
Yeah.
Pretty high. Mm-hmm. Not perfect, but pretty good. Their math proficiency is in the 50s or below.
Yeah.
Not so great. Mm-hmm. Right? You put these two things together, mm-hmm. and you add together, you know, a bunch of other indicators. Mm-hmm. You know, again, what do you come up with? So what would be your counsel to states to ensure that if you're going to move to a letter grading system, mm-hmm. that you don't have the scenario where high achievement on one thing
right.
masks low achievement on something else? Because then you don't really have the transparency that we agree is really important
right.
for these systems to be communicating.
So your worry would be, even though the grad rate, or let's say the math proficiency mm-hmm. rate is reported, it might be buried.
So you get a B, right? And so then it's unclear. So if you get a B, general thinking is, okay, school's decent.
Yeah.
What's not, then, even though there's mm-hmm. this data somewhere else that you have to, you know, click around for.
Yeah.
The focus gets on mm-hmm. the B.
Right.
And so then the pockets of low performance.
Yeah.
They get missed.
All right. So first I'd say, so states have to set priorities. So let's imagine that a state like Ohio decides, okay, we're not going to have just one rating, we're not going to have a dashboard, we're going to have six grades that we really want to have attention to. So you've got to think through, which of those do you want to have? You know, and do you want to have graduation rates be at one? Do you want to have achievement be one? You know, maybe you want to have it so that you have, for high school, graduation rate. That is an important measure. Achievement, so you know that, well, these kids are graduating, but they're graduating, you know, with pretty low proficiency levels. But then also growth, because growth is mm-hmm. the thing that they can actually control. All right, and that might be the way to do it. But go back to your example. I mean, I would argue that these high schools, if their proficiency rates are low, but let's imagine their growth rates are high and their graduation rates are high. I would argue those are some pretty darn good high schools. Okay, that again, if you're a high school, especially because you're at the end of the education system, you are going to have kids coming in way below grade level, and you have no control over
that. But the issue, though, is that with the single summative score,
yeah,
whether they're growing
yeah.
or whether they're not growing
yeah.
could easily be missed based on other things in the system.
Well, I think
if you don't have an Ohio-esque approach, right where you're looking,
right.
where it's front and center, and actually, instead of just, we'll actually show a slide from an Ohio school.
All right.
Because another point of agreement, I think that they do a good job of not just focusing on the single summative score, but you can see fairly clearly where each...
And it does mean that if you're going to have a summative score, like Ohio plans to, you better make sure that it's putting the weight on the right stuff.
Yeah.
Again, that's the focus of our report. Yeah. I certainly...
I thought it was interesting, though, with your report. Even you guys didn't give each state just a single summative score, which I respected.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting given the argument being made.
Yeah.
But you gave schools, you know, strong, right. medium, weak.
Right.
And I thought that really spoke to the to the need for some nuance, and
right.
that it's hard, and I'm not terribly worried about being fair to adults mm-hmm. in the system. Obviously, we should be fair, but to me, the ultimate concern mm-hmm. is, are we being clear and accurate,
right?
And to me, the clear dashboard, the multiple ratings,
mm-hmm.
you get to both clarity and accuracy. Whereas if you just have one, you lose the accuracy for the clarity.
But you are arguing, I think, like I am, for maybe a handful of grades. That's hugely different than a dashboard with 100 boxes.
So I agree that the hundred boxes with colors here and colors there may be useful for some things, not for transparency for most parents in the public. I think that should all be publicly available.
But I
would agree with you. It's not helpful to have to search for our students that look like mine or children that look like mine graduating. Like that needs to be clear. And I think that it's putting that into some context, whether it's a letter grade or five star system. I think that's okay. What really worries me is when we have the focus on just a single summative, and there's not more than that, because I think that the single summative sort of sucks the air out of the room, sucks the attention from the from
the
page.
Yeah.
And in fact, so I got have a an example of this, particularly when it comes to student subgroups with historically underserved kids. So if we can go to the PowerPoint slides. So this is an example. We wanted to, this doesn't show the name of the school, doesn't show the state that it's from, but we wanted to illustrate this point. This is an example, again, out of a high school where they're rated an excellent in 2015. We looked, they're also rated an excellent for the year following. They didn't have ratings yet. But so when we look at this, excellent school, good on growth. Things are looking pretty good. But then when you look down into the details, you see, wait a second. African-American graduation rate, 60%. Not so excellent. So how do we make sure that this front page of the report card, which says excellent school, really reflects all kids, including historically underserved kids? When we had the, under the original Obama regulation, there was a requirement saying that if you had a group of consistently underperforming students, the letter grade had to be reduced.
And in some
states, I think, do a decent job, in some cases more than a decent job, of ensuring that historically underserved kids are represented. Tennessee, 40% of their letter grade is based on student subgroups. In Louisiana and Illinois, you can't get the highest score in the system if you have a consistently underperforming group of kids. But a lot of states don't. So what would be some advice that you'd have for schools to avoid the situation where it says excellent, front and center, but then you peel back the onion and it's not just a small problem for historically underserved kids, but 60% graduation rate, that's a big deal.
So I think that the basic insight is right, that it makes sense to have a letter grade drop if certain subgroups are not performing well. I would question, I'm curious about, why this dynamic works just in terms of the math of it, How is it that the school was able to get...
So it comes out to how things are weighted. In most systems, individual student subgroups don't actually count in the rating.
As the weighting.
And so in the law actually says that they're supposed to, but the way this is playing out in the Department of Ed... I don't think really has been looking at this carefully enough. And then what's interesting is that when you look at the math, even if you do, so let's say you take your four required indicators, and then you have math and reading as part of that. So it's really sort of five, If you divide each of those five into the required subgroups, the performance of each subgroup on each indicator, matters for less than 3% of an index.
So at that point,
the math speaks against the single summative score, because then if you have low-performing African-American kids or another subgroup, it's just mathematically not going to show up in the letter grade.
Well, or another way to say it is, I suspect that this must be a school where the African-American subgroup is quite small.
It's about 10% of the population,
10%,
actually.
Okay. But that's small, right? So if it were larger...
It is 10% of...
Okay, but hold on. But if it were larger, then, the graduation rate as a whole would have been dragged down more, and that would show up in the rating. So I understand. I think you're going to be able to find some schools like this. I think they're going to be relatively rare, in part, honestly, Phil, because of the nature of our school system being so segregated. And so, that most of the schools, especially that serve low-income kids and kids of color, are highly segregated. They're high poverty. They're
so
high.
What's interesting, though, is that it's actually not the case. So yeah. A couple years back, Education Trust, actually, and they're big summative score proponents, they did a report and found that in one state, different state, in schools that got an A, on average, African-American students, proficiency rate, 58%.
Okay, well, let's pause on that. Why are we judging schools based on proficiency rates? Why? Well, how? And this is, if you ask any scholar out there, anybody who is, you know, studies evaluation for a living, how do you evaluate schools? I guarantee you, 100% of them will say, do not use proficiency rates, because those proficiency rates are measures of also anything that happened in that kid's life before they got to that test, right? And if you're especially, you know, if a middle school or a high school, it has a huge amount to do with the schooling they got before they got to you, right? So it could be. So
all of that is true.
If they did the same analysis and found that there were a lot of schools out there that were getting A's where the African-American kids weren't making any progress on value added or student growth percentiles, however you measure it, I would be concerned about that. I would be. But if it, you know, but the proficiency rate, this is where, Philip, I feel like a lot of reformers, we end up guilty of just not being good at math, okay? and also, frankly,
the irony there is striking.
Having utopian goals, which is to say that, you know, look, we are at a time when we've set the standards much higher, when about 40% of kids are meeting the standard, which is about the same level of how many kids are leaving our system ready for college. Okay, so we've set that bar at quite a high level. The percentages are much lower for poor and minority kids for a million reasons that we can talk about. We're all working on changing that.
Yeah.
Okay, but to say, you know, that a 58% proficiency rate for African Americans is bad, well, actually, that's better than the national average for kids as a whole, and it's probably three times as high as the average for African American
kids. But if you were to tell a parent that their school is good, it's an A school, but 4 out of 10, if you're an African-American parent, but 4 out of 10 students who look like your child,
right,
they're not reading at grade level.
Right. Well, again, proficiency no longer means grade level.
Well,
okay.
In the grand scheme of things, I mean, that is the
four
case.
4 out of 10 are not on track for college.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Is that... To me, that's just, again, it's clear, but it's not accurate.
Well, see, all right, so it gets you back to this idea of saying, all right, but if let's say then we're all agreeing that let's have a couple of grades. Mm-hmm. And so that school gets an A for growth and it gets a C for achievement, okay? And then the parent says, well, what does that mean? And then you say, well, that means that the population, you know, is achieving so-so in terms of how many kids are hitting this proficiency level. But man, they're making a lot of progress over time, and that to me is an accurate read on what's happening. I certainly don't want that school to get only a C or a D, because Philip, then you've told the school they're going to figure out, and they figure this out, No Child Left Behind. They say, look, no matter what we do, we work miracles in this school, and the best we're ever going to get is a C or a D, because you know we're helping kids make huge progress, but they're starting three grade levels behind when they get to us.
So yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you that we should be valuing, rewarding, promoting and expanding schools that can show that they're taking students from 2-3 years behind and they're bringing them up to grade level. But it does concern me. I mean, we have, you know, tons of stories of students who are, you know, valedictorians in their class, and then you go to, you know, to post-secondary, you go to college, and they need remediation.
Well, and this is why, and again, an important distinction for reformers out there, Philip, is, you know, I made the case again and again, that growth is the way to evaluate schools, okay? But when it comes to kids, it is hugely important that they and their families know how they are doing against these benchmarks. So for them, I mean, they need to know growth too. They want to know what kind of trajectory, are you making progress every year? But they really also do want to know, are you at this on-track level or not? And how much progress would you need to make to get caught up? Totally, okay? So that you don't have kids who are valedictorians and think they're on track and end up in remedial education, okay? But we have to think about these things differently, and we have to be smart about it, or else, you know what's going to happen? We're back in the same trap with No Child Left Behind, where people say, well, we have to set the goal at 100% proficiency, because otherwise, you know, anything less, do you want anything less for your own child? You know, and so we're back into the utopian land, where we set goals that are unachievable, or we create this dynamic where you say, well, the only way we're going to get to 100% is if we define proficiency down. And so now, well, we could get 100% of kids to this minimal level of proficiency, and so we'll do that. So if we want to maintain high standards, we got to accept, Philip, we're at 40% of kids reaching those high standards.
There's a huge disconnect between, which I think Bill will agree, there's a huge disconnect between the percentage of kids who are graduating, you know, average 84% you know, nationwide, and then you look at the college maturity rate, and like you're saying, it's in the 40s along with the proficiency rate. That gap is hugely problematic.
So we want to increase the percentage, okay? But the worst thing we could do right now is to say, well, unless you're getting 100% of kids to college and career readiness, you're not in A school.
So I agree with that, but by and large, that's not what's happening in the state systems. The state's goals are by and large, I would say, pretty high. You would say utopian.
Mm-hmm.
But progress against those goals doesn't actually matter in the systems.
That's right. That's why we didn't pay attention to
the goals.
So, yeah. Right.
So the goals are aspirational. Mm-hmm. It says we care about all kids and we want all kids to achieve.
Yep.
A number of states didn't even really base their goals on prior performance data. It was really just an aspirational exercise. And we actually, in our assessment of state goals, even if a state's goals were, say, in the 60s, but it represented monumental growth over time, we weren't going to ding them for not then saying, no, actually, you have to have 90%. So totally understand that. I think the issue, though, is that, you know, within these systems, if it all comes down to the letter grade, you know, that letter grade really has to mean something. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding is that because of the math, the student subgroup performance isn't well reflected in that ultimate letter grade.
Right. No, and I hear that. And I think there are going to be some schools with relatively small percentages of, you know, where the African-American kids are 10% of the student body, where that risk is there.
Well, and what we've seen in the data, and we're all going to those, you know, data wonks, you know, policy geeks amongst us, and we'll be diving into how this works when the state systems that are being approved now actually roll out. As we've looked at this information from the past, I mean, it definitely varies.
Yeah.
But so in the state that was represented in the and the example that we gave, that scenario of high letter grade but low grad rate for a subgroup, that was 10% of the high schools.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a substantial number. We've seen similar data for other states where it's like half of the schools have this scenario. Because the idea of the segregation amongst the schools is definitely true, but it's also true that, I forget what the exact number is, but there are a whole lot of school districts and schools that are still predominantly white.
Yeah.
And so this dynamic really plays out that if we're really going to value all kids and put the emphasis on all kids, you know, and outside the major metropolitan areas, then we're going to have these letter grades.
Yeah,
we've got to make sure that they count for all kids.
Right.
So why don't we get to some questions that have come from our audience? We appreciate when folks weigh in with questions before we even have the webinar. So first, this question comes from Mike from Chicago, similar to a question they received from Andrew from Phoenix. And we've talked a bit about this, so we can just summarize. So Mike asks, what effective alternate other than A to F methodologies exist to evaluate the effectiveness of K-12 schools? Andrew from Phoenix asks, are we arriving at this dichotomy for the topic, either no grade or a single grade? What are your views on the DASH-F concept involving several indicators? And I think by and large, we actually agree that the best case scenario, I think we disagree on the value of the ultimate summative, but we agree on the value of multiple ratings for multiple indicators, as you don't get like 15.
Right, I'd say a handful.
On a handful, yeah.
Imagine a kid's report card has usually 5 or 6 subjects.
Yeah.
You know, a high school report card, so 5 or 6 grades.
Yeah. And so actually, if we can show the slide real fast, this is an example of a school in Ohio. So hats off to our friends in Ohio for the clarity here and where you can see. And what's interesting, so this is school grade coming in 2018. So my argument would be, I'm not sure how much value the school grade actually adds. Because you see here, there's an A for graduation rate, there's a D for achievement, there's a B for progress. So what's the school grade going to end up being? Is it a C or a D?
Probably all the schools in the state are going to get a C.
Right. And so, like, what does that actually mean? Here, you've got the different component. I actually think that it's that this is... It's both clear and accurate. It gives now the one downside I would say here, because there's only so much that can fit on a single piece of paper, is that the performance of historically underserved kids, you'd have to click for more information. Yeah. Yeah. And I wish there was a way to clearly illustrate that. Oh wait a second, there might be. So here, this is a dashboard that is that we developed here after looking through some state examples, where here you can have that single summative score for different indicators. So it's not really a single summative score. We included the school rating out to the out to the top left, intentionally smaller than the other items, but so you can see very clearly the how subgroups are doing in these different areas. Now, incidentally, this data comes from a real school, and I mean from pre ESSA, and the C in the grad rate, the C in the math proficiency rate, the A in the reading proficiency, it translated into an A.
Yeah.
So again, so it'd come back to, I know you would say like where's growth here?
Yeah.
But it's just it to me it just goes to that point of if we focus on that single summative these other points.
Can I wonk it up one more
please
level?
Please do, yes.
So looking at this screen, the one other tricky thing is, let's say we do want to do more growth. Well, once you're looking at growth and you're looking at scores from year to year, you need an even bigger data set in order for those growth scores to be valid.
And more testing.
And more. So here's the challenge is, you want to move to growth, but then if you want to look at, for example, growth for African-American students, if that's a small group of kids, that's not going to be reliable. We see this in Ohio where... we're not capable of breaking out value added for subgroups, at least a lot of the subgroups. And so, the very schools
which
you're worried
about. Which
speaks
to another wonky issue is that I think we need smaller end sizes so that you can...
Yeah, but some of it is just because of the data. They've been bouncing around. It's the same reason why value added at teacher level is problematic because there's not enough kids, elementary school especially. So, so if you want to look at growth and you want to look at subgroups, it'll work if the subgroups are big enough. But if the subgroups are big enough, that's going to impact the overall growth score anyways. And if the subgroups are too small, you probably aren't going to be able to get a read on it. So it really,
in
you
theory,
get these trade-offs.
Because, I mean, in so many of these state systems, it's growth of all kids.
Yeah.
It's not growth of subgroups.
Right, right.
So if the population is big enough, it'll have an impact. If it's not, then... So just a reminder that if you'd like to send a question, we don't have that much time, but please do send your questions to questions@allfored.org. So a few other items here. So this one comes from Micheline from Clinton Township, Michigan.
Right.
She asks, what determines the criteria of a school's grade? Is it our state legislature or is it the federal legislature? And also, if a school gets a bad grade, like a C or a lower, how can they improve?
Wow. How much time do you have?
Yeah.
Good questions. So first of all, the law that was drafted and enacted by Congress sets, as you said at the beginning, a bunch of guidelines, some parameters. So, they have to include student achievement and they can include student growth. They got to look at graduation rates. So the basic infrastructure is set by Congress. But then this law gives a whole lot more flexibility back to the states. So the states get to really flesh it out. In most states, the process was led by the State Department of Education and the state superintendent. In some states, though, the legislatures did get involved and got engaged in passing laws saying what they thought should be in these systems.
And Maryland,
or they're doing
in
it on the back end.
Yeah.
So it can be a combination. It kind of depends on the state who gets to decide. Basically, the legislatures decide they want to be involved, then they get
then
themselves
involved.
As you go forward. And now, look, in terms of the low-performing schools, this is a whole nother topic we haven't really talked about, which is part of the conversation with accountability, which is if you have a chronically low-performing school, under the law, it's supposed to be labeled as needing an intervention, then what? States are supposed to say what their plan is for those schools. And most people have looked at that part of the plan, come away pretty disappointed. Now, I think the states had an incentive to say very little here.
They weren't required to say very much, and the difference between what's on paper and what actually happens can be pretty significant. So it's
And let's be honest, Philip, you know, there's not a lot of great examples to point to of things that work for turning around low performing schools.
So there's an additional series of webinars there. Yeah. I actually think that we've seen many examples of success. I point to New York City and their small schools of choice and Link Learning in California. But I think that the issue is that we haven't really been able to take what's working in different places, learn from it, and not replicate it. Every place is different. I don't think you can necessarily replicate it, but sort of apply what's...
Take it to scale.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying, though, Philip, is that, you know, is there, you know, what should the state of Michigan say it's going to do for its low-performing schools? I mean, I have opinions about that. I too, would say, well, I think what Louisiana did with its recovery school district looks pretty promising, where you create a district where you house all the low-performing schools and you can get rid of the teacher union contract, you get rid of the rules and regulations that are getting in the way, put more resources in. That's promising. I think what Texas is doing, where they're saying, hey, what we want to do, at least with some of our federal money, is start brand new charter schools in the communities that have lots of low-performing schools. Not doing turnarounds, but saying, let's create some high-quality schools from scratch that can be better alternatives than what kids are stuck in today. So there are opinions about that, but I don't think, I think we just have to be very humble that when it comes to what
that's
to do about chronically low-performing schools, nobody has completely figured this out.
No, that's, yes, yeah. Approaching this with a healthy dosage of humility is definitely the way to go. So Trey from Phoenix asks, you mentioned value-added earlier in this question. This question gets to that. He says, I'm curious to hear the panelists' thoughts about the inputs that go into the school letter grade. Mm-hmm. For example, in many states, teachers of the school's value-added scores contribute to a school's grade. Mm-hmm. Given the numerous debates surrounding the purported technical issues with value-added measures, couldn't we argue that school grades that use these potentially faulty inputs are biased and inaccurate from the start? I'm sure you have opinions about...
I do. So if I'm hearing this question right from Trey, is let's be clear to be different. Let's be clear to differentiate between value-added for teachers and value-added for schools. Okay. So, I mean, the same basic notion, which is let's look at the progress kids are making from one year to the next. Some of these models are more complicated than others. They make predictions based on the kid's trajectory or other issues. But the issue with the teachers, by and large, was that, especially in elementary schools, they've only got 25 or 30 kids. And therefore, it's not enough data to be really valid and reliable. These scores can bounce around a lot just randomly if, you know, a bunch of kids are sick on test day or whatever. And so... So we don't have the same confidence that these are actually doing a good job differentiating between different teachers. At a school level, because there's so many more kids, you should have enough data where these value-added scores are more reliable. Now, they still have issues. You still want to look over several years, and, you know, it's for smaller schools you can have a problem. So, it's, you know, but they tend to be better. Other states use student growth percentiles, which is another way of looking at it. So there's different ways to do this. But, look, this is a technology that exists and that is worth embracing because it's way better than the other alternative, which is to just look at how many kids are passing the test.
So John from Austin, Texas asks, expectations for 21st century teaching and learning, such as project-based learning and student-initiated instruction, seem to be at odds with high-stakes teaching, teaching to the test. Mm-hmm. High-stakes teaching, on the other hand, seems to be required to meet the expectations for school accountability and performance ratings. Can you explain how schools can incorporate 21st century teaching learning expectations while also meeting performance ratings that are directly tied to high-stakes testing?
Yep. Well, I note that this question is from Texas. I don't think that's completely out of line because, look, one problem is that Texas, unlike most states, did not adopt the Common Core. You know, one way to address this, to say we want our teaching and our learning to be more holistic, is to move to standards that themselves are expecting kids to be able to do more than just regurgitate stuff, but that to be able to write well, to do research, to, you know, to deal in math with conceptual understanding and all the rest that's in the Common Core. So Texas, you should adopt the Common Core. We'll see when that happens. And then the assessments in many states are much better. Now, that gets you so far. I mean, you know, this same with when we talk about high schools and you say, well, if you're teaching to a test, you know, that's not great. But if it's a good test, like the AP exams, where kids have to really show what they know, both on multiple choice kinds of things, but also in essays
writing,
or other right, then we feel like it's signaling, pushing schools in the direction of a pretty good teaching. Now, it still may not be enough for people who really are, you know, believers in project-based learning. And there the question is, again, can you come up with other ways to validate quality work in those kinds of domains? There are efforts out there. New Hampshire, for example, has been experimenting for years, trying to develop different kinds of assessments that look more like portfolios, more project-based. The challenge is, you know, those things, they can be expensive, and it's also really hard to get them to be valid and reliable.
Yeah, I think it's an issue at scale. I mean, I don't think that the push and pull between standardized testing and an emphasis on what some of us call deeper learning, mm-hmm. and higher level thinking skills. Yeah. I really don't think that there needs to be a dichotomy, the mm-hmm. one pulling at the other. One, like you were saying, Park and Smarter Balanced, we have assessments that measure higher order thinking skills in a way that's much more accurate, sophisticated than we had under NCLB.
Right. Much better.
And there's actually written into the law, states can incorporate projects, portfolios, performance assessments as part of that summative assessment. Yeah. The issue really is one, as you're saying, of validity, reliability. How do you do it at mm-hmm. scale in such a way that you won't have some kids in, you know, rich districts mm-hmm. that are constructing, you know, airplanes, and you have kids in lesser resource districts that are making paper airplanes, and calling that the project,
right?
That's so, so moving in this direction, you know, everything takes time. Mm-hmm. I think that states have really done a good job of incorporating these measures of college and career readiness. Mm-hmm. They're definitely, you know, they span the gamut. Some states, I think, do a better job of this than others, like Louisiana and Tennessee, I think, are at the have some good measures there, but pushing this idea. The other thing that I think, and I know you'll agree with this, mm-hmm. that will push where the accountability system is pushing this direction is states that are providing credit for not just proficiency, but above proficiency, which is, I know, one of the absolutely. Items that was in your report.
You know, really interesting study that just came out. We just wrote about it in our weekly newsletter, The Education Gadfly, available on our site
at
excellence.net.
There we go.
But fascinating study out of Michigan, really encouraging, where they were able to look at basically value-added by test scores of high schools. They looked at the 8th grade test scores for kids versus the 11th grade test scores. And what they were able to find was that the kids, the high schools that did better in terms of value added, their students went on to do better in college, right? After controlling mm-hmm. for all kinds of things. Now, the worry was that if high schools are focused on beefing up, getting those reading and math scores up, they would ignore the deeper learning stuff and kids would not do as well. Well, it turns out that at least in this one study, the things that those schools are doing that are helping kids read and write and do math better are also helping them do better, you know, prepare for more success in college, and not just in English and in math, but in all subjects. Even found that kids who went to better high schools, as judged by mm-hmm. value added, did better in welding. So the good, I mean, to me, that indicates that these tests, while imperfect, are measuring some batch of skills that matter in the real world.
Definitely. So James from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania asks, Pennsylvania has elected to use a dashboard model rather than a summative rating. What should parents look for in the dashboard to know if their neighborhood, their magnet, or charter school are providing a quality education?
That's a good question. Look, I mean, I'm going to sound like a broken record. I would focus mostly on the growth. If there's a growth score, a value-added score, I would hone in on that. Texas has an interesting model, by the way, where they basically have said, what we're going to do is we're going to look at growth and we're going to look at achievement. And whichever one is higher, that's the grade you get. And what's kind of cool about that is that if you're, let's say, a pretty affluent school in the suburbs, your achievement's probably pretty high, let's say, okay? And everybody thinks you're a great school. I mean, these are the schools everybody clamors mm-hmm. to get into. So fine, you get an A, okay? And maybe your value added, your growth isn't that great. But you know what? It's harder when you got a lot of kids at the top anyways. They might be topping out on these tests or they might... And it's fine. Nobody's going to argue that these are bad schools. Yeah. All right. So that's fine. And if you're a high poverty school and your achievement's not great, but your growth is amazing, then you are considered an A school. Right? Again, back to my KIPP analogy in Ohio, that school gets an A. I think that's actually pretty interesting. Now, we have some concerns about it for other reasons, but, you know, so I'd also say, look, if you're talking about a pretty affluent school, the achievement stuff is worth paying attention to. If it's a high poverty school, growth, growth, growth.
Gotcha. Well, with that, I think that will bring today's webinar to a close.
All right.
Well, this has been, I think, an important discussion, one that will be continued in the halls of Congress, state legislatures, departments of education, even some dinner tables. But yep. I want to thank you very much
for
joining us today.
My pleasure.
We will be having, I'm sure, many more webinars. Hopefully that if you're watching this, you are on our list. Know that this webinar will be archived at www.allfored.org/webinars. I'm Philip Lovell for the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thanks again to Mike Petrilli.
My pleasure.
Enjoy the rest of your day.